This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Dig for victory.
If you eat food, maybe you've noticed groceries cost more and more. Well, stock up now. Food inflation is just ramping up. It's not just the extra 200 million mouths to feed on the planet next year. Climate change is already rearranging your food bill. In North America and around the world, one big driver is the record drought in the prime crop production areas of the United States this year. Many meat producers gave up selling off their herds. That temporarily kept meat prices lower. The current cattle herd is the smallest since 1973. Once that sell-off goes through the supply chain, the high cost of corn and other grains will accelerate meat prices from 5 to 10% higher, according to one Canadian report. Here is Peter Mansbridge, the host of The National on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, on December 6, 2012.
If you are buying extra groceries for the holidays, some experts suggest you also might think about stocking up for the coming year. The price of food, especially meat, is expected to jump soon.
Next comes CBC Consumer Affairs reporter Aaron Saltzman with a report from Canada's premier agricultural university in Guelph, Ontario.
They'll soon learn it's about to get even more expensive, no matter where they shop. According to the University of Guelph's annual food forecast, just about every basic staple will cost more next year. Dairy up as much as 3%. Breads up as much as 4%. Eggs up as much as 5%, but likely the biggest hike.
We would expect meats, particularly beef and pork, to go up more significantly. We're saying probably as much as 4.5 to 6%.
The price of pork in particular expected to jump by as much as 10%. According to the report, the main driver behind most of these price increases is climate. The drought across parts of North America this past year was one of the worst in recorded history. Among the hardest hit areas, the Great Plains states in the U.S., America's breadbasket. That drove up grain prices and, in turn, the cost of feed and livestock.
So some predictions there about food prices in the future. What about the changes we've already seen? Here are some numbers to consider. According to Statistics Canada, the cost of meat has risen more than 30% in the past decade. Egg prices have risen by 50%. Bakery products are up by nearly 60%. By comparison, fresh vegetables cost about 1% less than 10 years ago.
That was CBC News. Don't be thrown off by comforting reports from the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization. Their early December report says basic food prices fell by 1.5% in November. That was partially caused by a massive drop in the price of sugar. But as the World Bank reports, food prices are currently stable, but still very high. In fact, expensive food hovering near the record 2008 levels is the new normal. Unlike the UN, the World Food Bank Price Index finds food prices are 7% higher than in 2011. Grains are 12% higher already from the previous year. In the United Kingdom, the November Shop Price Index shows food prices up 4.6% from a year ago. Fresh fruits and vegetables are particularly high there, causing what the Guardian newspaper calls a nutrition recession in Britain. A series of reports in the Australian press says food prices there will hit a new record high in 2013. The cost of rice, wheat, pulses, edible oil, sugar, and vegetables are all rising in India. Bloomberg Business finds American meat prices are set to go much higher. Quote from Bloomberg, the drought in the Midwest and Great Plains drove corn yields to a 17-year low and may last at least through February. U.S. consumers will pay 3% to 4% more for food next year, a half percentage point above this year's expected increase, according to the USDA. End quote from Bloomberg. It's not just the drought. A weird bout of summer-like weather in March 2012 caused many fruit trees to bloom early. The return of cold weather killed off the flowers, leading to a drop of the apple crop by as much as 80% in some regions. The world charity Oxfam has a special report on the impact of extreme weather events on the world food supply. And don't forget those great storms.
Do you like standing in a queue for your vegetables? Or do you think it's tiring and a waste of valuable time? Do you ever find your long wait has been useless, that supplies of what you want have run out before your turn comes? It's not the greengrocer's fault. It's up to you. Dig for victory. thousands of people have discovered that a 10-rod plot will keep a family of five in vegetables 8 months of the year. Young men are doing it, and young women. These girls are using part of their lunch hour to work on plots in their own factory grounds. Old men, even at 83. And children, growing food is part of their school routine nowadays. For they know that food is just as important a weapon of war as guns.
Radio EcoShock.
Wait a minute. Didn't I promise you some good news this week? Sure, if more people can't afford red meat, their health will improve dramatically. Healthy vegetables are still the most affordable option in most places. But it gets much better than that. We can quickly and cheaply convert most of our cities into major food production centers. In this program, you will hear how it happened before and how local urban food production is making a rapid comeback. The kicker is, lots of folks are going for more than just the joy of healthy, self-grown food. They come for the new sense of community as well. Most of us can't afford to just kick off and head to the country. We need some income, at least to make the transition. So like Havana, Cuba, after the Soviet Empire died and stopped sending oil, we'll have to feed ourselves where we are. We are going to the city of Chicago, where the American Victory Garden movement was launched during World War II, and where it is coming back strong now. From the Great Lakes Bioneers Conference, we have an excellent recording of Lamanda Joy, founder of the Peterson Garden Project. She tells us about the Victory Garden movement, where hundreds of thousands of novice growers produced mountains of food for the war effort, how a whole nation can transform into local food production in just 1 year. That's not just something that happened in the past. Lamanda will tell us how Chicago is organizing once again to bring back urban food production. Whether you are concerned about economic collapse, climate change, peak oil, or just healthy food with no GMOs in it, this speech is a message of hope for all of us. This recording was made by Kelly Pierce of the Chicago Independent Media Center for Radio EcoShock. Here is Lamanda Joy speaking November 4th, 2012, to the Great Lakes Bioneers.
My name's Lamanda Joy. I'm very happy to be here with you today. Does everybody understand what the concept of a victory garden is? Yeah, lots of nods. Okay, so we'll go ahead and skip over that. Why am I talking about them? You know, I know the conference these last couple days has been a lot about inspiration and passion and, you know, what we can all do to make a difference. And I feel very attached to this victory garden story for a lot of reasons. The first of all is my parents. I have greatest generation parents. They met in 1941, love at first sight, at the Samuel Gompers Junior High School in Los Angeles. Something else significant happened that year. We went into war. So my parents, as young adults, lived through that whole experience, or what you call the greatest generation. That's my handsome father. He was drafted and served in the occupied forces after the end of the wars in the occupied forces in Japan. So I grew up with a family that was talking about World War II a lot. You know, it was the biggest thing in their lives, and it has an impact to today. After the war was over, my parents moved to Oregon, where I was born, just outside of Portland, and my dad learned how to garden. And you'll notice in the background here, this is my great-grandfather's garden. During the war, it was a victory garden. After the war, it was just a garden again. My dad learned to garden there, and then when I came along in the late 60s, he taught me how to garden as I was growing up. So that's a little bit about that ethos. You know, I have this sort of unbroken chain of what happened during those times that I think is really valuable, so I'm very attached to this story and how it can make a difference for us today. Who here likes to garden? I hope that there's a few people. Okay, good. Who likes to eat? Everybody. Okay, good. Well, if you're an eater, then you're a good gardener. You have a good potential to be a gardener. Those of you that are gardeners, you know that once you get that bug, it's something that's kind of with you for a lifetime, right? So I got that bug very early growing up in Oregon, helping my dad garden. And I moved to Chicago in 94, and I lived for a number of years in a condo, which was lovely. It was a vintage condo. It overlooked the lake. It was very nice, but there was one problem. There's nowhere to garden. So every spring it got a little obnoxious. You know, where are we going to garden? How are we going to garden? You know, we can find neighbors with backyards. There was no community gardens to go to. It was a little bit of a problem. So February in 2006, my husband woke up one morning and he said, should we go look for a house? He's like, should we go look for a yard? I'm like, yes, let's go look for a yard. Go ahead and hit it. So we bought a yard with a house attached to it, and we called it the Yarden. So that was what it looked like when we got it, 4-foot chain link fence. Lots of sun. We didn't have any old trees that were casting shade. We didn't have any apartments looking down on it. It was nice. So we bought this yard, and there happened to be a house attached to it. And the next year, we put in this. So this is our Yarden. It's a 1,700 square feet, all organic. We do all open pollinated. We have espalier fruit trees. You know, this was my happy place, right? So I think many people are like this, or maybe I'm just like this, but I think that everybody's like me. You know, like everybody maybe has had the same experience. So I assume that everybody knew how to garden and can and bake and all cook, all these things that my parents had taught me, and I quickly learned that that wasn't the case. I started blogging about it, and I was like, whoa, people really don't know how to do this stuff, and they really want to do this stuff. So these are two of the factors that brought me to this story, but there's one more. Community. You know, I'd moved to this neighborhood. I'd been probably lived in 10 different places since I moved here in 94. Moved to this neighborhood. We were going to stay put, so we really wanted to support the community. And I was at my local butcher shop waiting for my order, and I looked at the wall, and I saw this photo. And I was like, what is that photo? So Reuben and Irv told me the story that this photo was taken at the building where their butcher shop was in 1943, actually. The woman that took it lived in the neighborhood her entire life, and when she passed away, her family came to the butcher shop and said, hey, we found this photo, do you want it? They collected old photos. They said, sure. They stuck it on the wall. I came in and saw it many years later, and I was like, huh. So all these things sort of came together. I'm like, huh, I really want to understand the Victory Garden movement. And I had heard a lot of statistics. Maybe you've heard them too. 200 million people gardened, 40% of the food or the produce consumed was homegrown. And I'm a little OCD, right? So I said, I'm going to figure out how they did this. That's a lot of people learning to garden. That's a lot of people growing food. How do you teach an entire city to grow their own food? So that became my research question. I really dove into what Chicago did to grow their own food during World War II. So we're going to talk a little bit about the world at war. You know, the world war started in 1941. It ended in 1945. And in between, we had four summers where people were victory gardening, 42, 43, 44, 45. Most of my information is about 1942 and 1943, so I don't have the full spectrum, but that's okay. We'll talk about those 2 years. So war on the home front. During the last part of 1941, when the country was actively preparing for war, for national defense, there were already signs of food shortages and rising prices, and especially in the category of fresh vegetables. Great industries were being transformed into munitions plants, and this quickly absorbed much of the country's pool of unemployed from the Depression. One of the first industries to feel the pinch of the labor shortage was that of fresh vegetable growers, as lower-paid field workers found higher-paying jobs in munitions and other war industries. So the farm workers were going to find better jobs, so there weren't people to grow the food. Another issue was transportation. Transportation lines were quickly conscripted to move troops and munitions, which also impacted the delivery of fresh vegetables from farms to urban areas. As one of the higher-ups in the Chicago Victory Garden movement phrased it, Uncle Sam needs trains for munitions, so we'll have to grow our own carrots. So from the smallest family groupings, and I hope that the mother was taking this picture and not pulling the plow, but we don't know because people were desperate in these times. So from the smallest family groupings to the largest organizations, people used whatever they could to prepare their victory gardens. Here you see Mayor Boston plowing up the Boston Commons. Everyone was drafted into the victory garden effort. Religious orders, movie stars. This is Veronica Lake. She was a very famous movie star at the time, and she was known for this beautiful hairstyle that she would wear. She's sort of like the peekaboo girl. She'd look from behind her hair. Well, people were emulating this hairstyle so much it was a problem because they're all becoming Rose of the Riveters, and their hair was getting caught in machinery. So they talked to Veronica Lake about doing a campaign called Hair Wins the War. If you Google that, it's a really interesting video about Hair Wins the War, how you need to change your hairstyle. So for the duration of the war, she wore her hair like this to encourage women to wear their hair up. I usually wear my hair like this when I'm gardening and presenting, but I was just too busy this morning. Anyway, movie stars were involved, cartoon characters, superheroes. I'd like to point out poor Robin schwitzing up there in his Speedo up in the corner. And, of course, popular culture. You know, you got really thirsty doing your victory garden, so you might need to drink a Dr. Pepper. Or if you got a little more thirsty, maybe you needed to drink your victory garden beer. Or if you were really thirsty, maybe you just drank a whiskey and let someone else do the gardening. But I'm just joking. I'm showing you these just to show how much this effort was part of popular culture. It wasn't something that was in the shadows. It was part of everything that people were doing. So back to the serious note. Industries, you know, steel mills, railway stations, Sears. Sears started 24,000 victory gardens in the Los Angeles area. Newspapers. And as I back to the popular culture, this is Marshall Fields. This is the window from Marshall Fields. And that sign says, to make your victory garden grow, wear gay and chic gardening apparel, located in the sport department on floor 6. So, of course, industries, especially garden industries, jumped in full force. International Harvester, which is a Chicago-based manufacturer of plows, are still here. They're called Navistar, was known to be a big supporter of the Victory Garden movement. And I'm just going to take a little detour. You know, You got to eat year-round. You can only garden for part of it. Canning was huge during World War II. So hand-in-hand with food production came food preservation. Modern freezing techniques were not widely used, and tin and other materials for store-bought canned foods were being used for munitions. So women were encouraged to can, dehydrate, brine, and otherwise preserve the harvest. And salute while you're doing it. So you can see that industrious preservation was serious business. It was a real war job. It wasn't just, oh, I'm going to make some jam to give away as Christmas gifts. There would be no food if you did not can. One of the research pieces that I ran across said that 5 billion pints were preserved during World War II every summer. Has anybody done any canning this summer? Yeah? You know, it's a lot of hot work, right? 5 billion pints nationwide. Pressure cookers and canning supplies were in such high demand that their production and distribution were overseen by the government. Serious business. So at the height of World War II, 24 million meals per day were served on the 50-plus battlefronts and fronts that the U.S. participated in. So you can see that the Victory Garden effort wasn't merely a morale-boosting luxury, it was a dire necessity. And so here's some words from the Times. Americans started gardening. Gardens began sprouting behind signposts, at the bases of railroad embankments, in schoolyards and churchyards, and in window boxes. They're attended by housewives who left babies in sandboxes while they knelt to scoop and sift the soil, and by little girls who wheeled their trowels and rakes into their plots in doll buggies, and by war workers who were back to the good earth for the first time since they waded barefoot in mud puddles as children. And so the historic gardening campaign of World War II began. So that's an overview of the nation, but let's talk specifically about Chicago. You know, I mentioned a little earlier that I'm OCD. You all know what that means. If you'll notice the acronym of this organization, they are OCD as well. So they did keep things very organized. Let's talk about the Office of Civilian Defense. Fiorello LaGuardia was appointed as the person in charge of the Office of Civilian Defense. He was not happy about this. He had other things he wanted to do, and they did not include working on the Office of Civilian Defense. But the original civilian defense organization was centered around preventative measures against air attack, sabotage, and the like. You know, there was a fear that our enemies would actually make it to our shores. So people were preparing, you know, air raids and stuff like that. It was recognized that that same organization might well function in the Victory Garden field, and the OCD administrator in D.C. issued a memorandum in January of 42 urging local coordinators to set up machinery for promoting victory gardens. Now, I have to tell you this from my extensive research. Not all cities use the Office of Civilian Defense as the mechanism for that. Chicago did heavily. Other cities did different things, but it seemed to work for us. So the Office of Civilian Defense activities were air raid surveillance, attack training, scrap and fat collection, war bond sales, morale committees, and victory gardens. So rumor has it that the Office of Civilian Defense was the brainchild of Eleanor Roosevelt. She understood the impact of the First World War on the nation, and she wanted people to feel involved, feel like they were active, not just sitting here passively while all the horribleness was going on overseas. So it was her idea. However, you know, the wife of the president at that time couldn't be, you know, the brainchild of something like that or run something like that. So for a number of months, 18 months, she went to New York, and she was Fiorello LaGuardia's secretary. So he didn't want to do it, so she became his secretary and sort of ran things from the shadows. So Chicago. Here's some words from the time. Victory gardening in World War II was radically different in character and extent from the corresponding activity in World War I. Lack of sustained promotion, absence of any organized scheme of promoting gardening, and general haphazard and wasteful methods destroyed much of the usefulness and productivity of the so-called war garden movement in World War I. World War II, at least, we'd learned from our mistakes, at least in Chicago, most of these faults were recognized before actual fighting took place. A thorough and complete scheme of organization was set up, largely due to the aid of the Chicago Park District, the local Office of Civilian Defense. There was a continuous program of promotion, stimulation, guidance, and active help. So this was our mayor at the time, Mayor Kelly, and he quickly appointed some Park District bigwigs to run the program. You know, we were lucky at the time. The Park District was probably the strongest it has ever been. Less than 10 years before 1941, in the mid-30s, we had three park districts. They're all run separately. They're all conglomerated into one park district. So they were very well organized. They had gone through this process of, you know, making their communications good. We also were in the Depression, so Chicago could afford really, you know, high-class Ivy League horticulturalists and business people to help with the park district. So we were in a really lucky spot at that time to have a solid, strong park district to help lead the way. So the goals of the Victory Garden movement were to stimulate as many people as possible to apply themselves during their leisure hours. They weren't expecting, you know, people to quit their jobs or do whatever. This was a leisure hour pursuit. They wanted to provide novice gardeners and those not familiar with vegetable growing the information they needed to make their efforts most productive. And you know this was written by a gardener because the final one lay a foundation for the continued expansion of the program in peacetime. You know, maybe if that had happened, we'd be in a different world today, but we're not. And so the resources to accomplish this were a lot of vacant lots, backyards, a strong park system, school district, libraries, corporate support, and a devoted citizenry, of which 90% had never gardened before. So it wasn't that they had landscape gardened and they didn't know how to grow food. They had never gardened before. So to accomplish this and the other mandates of the Office of Civilian Defense, the city was divided into 7 divisions, and there were more divisions in the suburbs. Division 7 doesn't show on here because it wasn't deemed to be important or possible to grow food. And all 77 Chicago neighborhoods were segregated into one of these 7 divisions. Each division had a division chairman that reported to the OCD. And each neighborhood had a community chairman that reported to the division chairman. And each block had a block captain that reported to the community chairman. And then there were also other committees, the advisory committee, the committee on demonstration gardens, the general committee, the committee on food preservation, the committee on planning, and the committee on kinds of vegetables. So there was lots of organization going on. But that's a good thing, because that meant that we were able to have the information that we have today. Because they kept track of everything. There was this level of bureaucracy that people had to work through, and it was very successful. So block captains, they're the ones that actually got most of the work done. This was their duty, to find land 3 or 4 blocks from homes of interested parties, prepare the site, arrange for plowing, participate in the Victory Garden Council, maintain enthusiasm, and plan harvest festivals. So let's take a little detour and talk about harvest festivals. This was a festival that happened in Streeterville. Streeterville is not far from Michigan Avenue. I like to show this photo because we've been interviewing senior citizens that remember Victory Gardening. And one woman lived in this neighborhood, and she said down by the lake, although you know, this was technically Division 7, she said down by the lake there are Victory Gardens as far as the eye could see. So people took whatever space they could as far as the eye could see to grow their Victory Gardens. So this image shows the Soldier Field Harvest Festival. It was held in the exhibition hall underneath the seats in the south end of the old Soldier Field. So to us, that's the old Soldier Field. This was sponsored by the Chicago Sun, and practically every community in the Chicago metropolitan area participated. Hundreds of exhibits of garden produce, flowers, and canned goods were featured. The Park District and commercial growers also participated. Thousands of visitors participated and pledged to grow Victory Gardens in 1944.
With food inflation hard upon us and agribusiness food getting less nutritious, how can we ensure a healthy supply in our cities? This is Radio EcoShock. You are listening to Chicago Victory Gardens, Yesterday and Tomorrow, with Lamanda Joy of the Peterson Garden Project.
So Chicago, as you can see, was really serious, very organized about their Victory Garden effort, to the point where they passed an ordinance that if someone were to damage or pilfer or steal from a Victory Garden, there's an ordinance passed that you would get fines. So those fines were, and this was made effective in July of 1924, which to me is like some bigwig's wife got her beautiful tomatoes stolen. So, you know, okay, now's the time. Let's pass the ordinance. But anyway, there were fines of $50 to $200 levied on people that were caught busted, you know, pilfering Victory Gardens. In today's currency, that would be $650 to $2,600. It's a lot of money. Well, the question is, well, how would you know if something was a Victory Garden or just, you know, a garden? How would it apply? What is believed to be the first system of reporting or recording Victory Garden efforts for statistical purposes of any part of the United States was established in Chicago in 1942. A simple distribution system of decals in exchange for information was used, and a great deal of energy was on the part of the block captains was required. So what happened is, they called it decalomania. I think 6-color printing was a big deal back then, but 75,000 were distributed in 1942, and another 100,000 were distributed in 1943. And what happened is you gave your name, your home address, where the size of the garden was, you know, the location. Now, right, boring, snoozy statistics. The reason that we know that we had 20 million Victory Gardens across the country and 40% of the produce was grown is because this idea took off. It was Chicago's idea. It took off to the rest of the country, and cities, other metropolitan locations across the nation adopted this statistical method. So you can thank Chicago for those sound bites that we now hear. And then you started seeing these photos popping up in all sorts of press photos. This is a demo garden at Lincoln Park. This is Little Village. This is another one. Now this tall gentleman here is the man responsible for, he worked for the Park District. He was on the Victory Garden Committee. He's the one that was responsible for the decal. He's very proud of it. He's pointing there at it. And I just want to point out that 90% of these people had never gardened before, right? You can tell by the clothing that they're wearing. So, of course, it was very important to educate people since people didn't know what they were doing. An extensive program of lectures in 6 different locations throughout the city were given. Horticultural staff in the Park District led those lectures, leaders in the seed trade, commercial growers. And in addition, individual lectures were provided by garden clubs and other organizations. In 1943, 162 sanctioned garden lectures happened across these six locations. And then countless garden club lectures, which I assume were unsanctioned lectures, but they're not in the stats. And then there were mass meetings showing movies or slideshows. So if you go to YouTube and put in Victory Garden movie, it'll pull up one of these movies. There's a lot of sweeping orchestration and a very serious narrator talking about how the family's growing their own food and what they're doing. But it's interesting, you know, and I like to think all these people got together and watched, you know, these propaganda movies to learn how to grow their own food.
You can have vegetables, lots of them, on your table next winter. You can have your own fresh vegetables on your table this summer if you have your own Victory Garden. Yes, there's no restriction on home canning and home processing of vegetables and garden fruits and berries. Plan your Victory Garden now. Get your garden plot lined up. Get the advice of a garden expert if you need it. And be prepared to grow your own for victory. Join a garden club or community garden movement, or share a garden with your neighbor. You can help win the battle of food production. You can help our fighting men get the food they need. You can help save the vital metals used in commercial canning if you grow your own Victory Garden in 1943.
Newspapers were also involved. They passed out a lot of pamphlets that talked about Victory Garden. Now, this wasn't ornamental. This wasn't make it pretty. This was just the down and dirty of growing food. At the time, we were just coming out of the Depression. So about 30% of the men that were going to be drafted could not be drafted because of malnutrition. So vitamins and nutrition and played a big part in this information, much like we need today, very similar situation. Let's go to the next one. There are also plans that people would hand out. You know, if you have this size garden, here's a plan for a family of four. Here's another one. Here's a plan for a family of five. And these are very, very specific. They have a little bit of succession planting information. They recommend crops that are good for Chicago. It was all very specific to Chicago. There are articles in the paper, special interest articles, weekly columns from garden experts. I love this. This is a radio program called Know Your Onions on WGN. It happened Monday through Friday, and what happened is, you know, the block captains would be out in their gardens, and you'd be hearing what the problem is. This year we had a lot of problem with squash vine borers and a few other things, you know. So they'd hear what the problems are, would trickle up through the OCD bureaucracy, and they'd be very quickly able to address these problems and teach people, okay, you're having a problem with squash vine borers, here's how you deal with it. But there are also some public interest stories that happen on this show, and I would like to share with you some of the headlines that I found in my research. Rejoice, kids, spinach seeds to be scarce. Did anybody read that book a couple years ago, The $25 Victory Garden? No, it was a pretty good book. Anyway, big profit on 64 cents. So back then it was a 64 cent Victory Garden. Joe Green, busy in his garden, forgets taxes. And then here we get to the fishing stories. The 4-foot radish, maybe, I don't know, maybe it was a daikon. 41 inch bean, maybe. 12 pound cabbage, I can believe that. But here's my favorite headline from the Times. Man who traded Victory Garden truck for beer, wife divorces him. Social media. What? How can that be? They didn't have Twitter back then. They actually did have something social. They had these little kiosks that were at every garden, every corner. And so if there was a newspaper article, or hey, we're all going to get together and weed, or hey, go see Hair Wins the War at the library this weekend, all the information that you might need to know about your garden or about your community, what was happening, would be displayed in these little kiosk things. And I have seen so many photos of these little girls standing in front of them, seen them all over at the Library of Congress. It's just very interesting. That was a very key point of how people got their information.
In just a minute, Radio EcoShock continues with Lamanda Joy on Victory Gardens, Yesterday and Tomorrow, from the Great Lakes Pioneers Conference Meetup in Chicago, November 2012. Find out what is going on today and how you can do it in your own city or town. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Worried about high food prices, climate change, peak oil, and an unstable economy? How can you feed yourself? We return to our feature presentation, Chicago Victory Gardens, Yesterday and Tomorrow, with Lamanda Joy of the Peterson Garden Project. It was recorded for the Great Lakes Pioneers.
Now I have to tell you a funny story. First time I did this lecture years ago, I got to this section. It was at the Chicago Flower and Garden Show, and a family walked in, saw this slide, and turned around and walked out. Plowing doesn't sound like a very important or interesting topic, but it was very important. And now I will proceed to show you my collection, what I like to call plow porn. And it usually involves some proletariat-looking guy sitting on a tractor shaking hands with someone, you know, in a fedora. I mentioned International Harvester earlier. Early in 1942, International Harvester was approached, and they very patriotically and promptly turned over three new plows for the plowing of vacant property in city limits. The Park District provided operators fuel and supplies for these plows. Demand for plowing was so intense, rules were set up to regulate it. These were some of the rules. The plot had to be a certain size. There had to be a certain opening. You had to have written permission from the landowner. You had to be inspected to make sure that the soil was good. It was level, free of debris. It had to be sunny and fertile. And four families were required to participate. So those were the rules for the Victory Gardens, at least where the plowing was concerned. And this wasn't just community gardens. This also could be, well, families had to be involved, but small gardens, huge gardens, the plows were busy. I'm going to read what the back of this photo says. This shows the tractor plow provided by the Victory Garden Department, Office of Civilian Defense, through the cooperation of the Chicago Park District and the International Harvester Company. This Victory Garden is being prepared at the vacant lot at 5400 Ferdinand Street. The man with the rake is Frank L. Bennett, head of the Concert Bureau, who resides in the building shown in the background and who is the moving spirit in developing this Victory Garden. This shows the same area included in photo A, except now Mr. Bennett and his neighbors have something to show for their labors. The garden is located in North Austin community, where Mr. Bennett is Victory Garden community chairman. He got a promotion. Notice the shrinkage in his waistline as a result of his gardening activities. This photo is taken at the inception of the community Victory Garden at 50th and Ingleside, a congested apartment house district of Chicago. The tractor plow, provided by the International Harvester Company for the Victory Garden Committee, is preparing the soil at an unsightly vacant lot that later will be transformed to a neat and productive garden. Local civilian defense group is studying the soil. You can see them over there checking out the soil. So this one didn't say anything on the back of it, but it's at Howard and Bell, which is the dividing line between Chicago and Evanston. And I love this photo because you see the plow, you see the little policeman checking it out. So this is another photo, another plow porn photo. Sprung originally from the Green Prairie Acres of the Midwest, Chicago goes back to the soil as their citizens began a tremendous Victory Garden campaign. One of more than 300 projected community gardens on the north side, Division 6, is this portion of the Emerald Turf back campus of the Presbyterian Theological Seminary at Belden and Bissell. So I was doing this lecture at DePaul, and when I was done, the instructor said, you know, that's right around the corner. I'm like, oh, sure, I'm sure. He's like, no, literally. So I gathered my stuff. We went around the corner. It's literally right around the corner. So that shows where they were actually plowing. And this area, in the past there, is a giant soccer field. So between the shrub and the soccer field, there's about 30 feet by about 150 feet. So I've been picking on them, lobbying, you know, wouldn't it be great to put another Victory Garden in? Wouldn't that be a good educational thing for your students to understand they have all that empty space? And I did learn that they put a Victory Garden in, small garden. It's a little farther this way, but it is on that place. So it does make me happy that the land's being used for that again. So here's the tally for plowing in 1942. This doesn't include people that were gardening in their homes. It just includes community gardens that were plowed by the city. 508 separate community plots, some as large as 6 to 8 acres. An additional 1,500 community plots, including Division 5, the largest Victory Garden in the nation. That is located at St. Louis and Foster, Northeastern University. It was 32 acres and 800 families garden there. So I mentioned earlier that I've been talking with the senior citizens about their remembrances. One of the guys I talked to, loved him, Ron, he gardened at that garden. And he is the historian, used to be the historian for the Tribune. So he said, he's like, Lamanda, I believed it then, I believe it now, I believe that my Victory Garden has won the war. And that was the point of the Victory Garden movement, so people could feel like their effort made a difference, right? He told me once that he had to go speak there, because he was, you know, he's a historian. He pulled in the parking lot, and he said it was very close to where their garden was. He said he couldn't get out of the car. He said he sat there for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, just remembering the effort, you know, 32 acres, 800 people, and how he felt participating in something like that. It was a really beautiful story. Kids were not safe from the OCD. Recognizing the rising enthusiasm for Victory Gardening by adults might demand much of the lawn space in Chicago parks, the Victory Garden Department suggested in the latter part of 1942 that school children's plots be set aside on park property during the 1943 season. All city parks were surveyed to determine suitable spaces where good soil and sunlight were available and other recreational uses would not be interfered with. Working with public schools and youth leaders, 5th through 8th graders were provided with plots on school property or on park property. The poor weather conditions in 1943 interfered with this plan. By the time growing could start, many of the children had lost interest, so instead of 30,000 plots being assigned, only 14,000 were assigned. Only 14,000. I had mentioned earlier that parades and hoo-ha was important. Here's the children's parade. This is what this photo said. Thousands of children in the upper grammar grades are being assigned garden plots, 5 by 12 in size, in 65 of Chicago's parks this week and next week. The typical planting plan for these plots includes a row of petunias at one end and zinnias at the other, with rows of lettuce, radish, snap beans, kohlrabi, carrots, and beets in between. Complete seed packets containing just the right amount of seed for each of these rows has been prepared and provided for the children with the compliments of Marshall Field and Company. Here are some of the children marching to their plots in parade form from Garfield Park. Have you ever seen those Frankenstein movies where the villagers are going after Frankenstein with the torches of the... This is like the daylight children's version. These kids are so into it. Like that little girl, I wish I had my pointer. I like to point some of these things out. That little girl with her digger, she's serious. There's some serious business happening here. I also like it because you see some of these posters, which, you know, we now think of as retro, but that was them, modern, carrying them around, the symbols of the war. This guy, little guy in the front, is holding a sign that shows what he's going to garden, what he's going to grow, his different seed packets, his little plan. I'm going to veer off a little bit. We are talking about urban gardening, but you know, it was a big effort with rural areas too. You know, 4-H is a big program in rural areas for farm kids to get to show their livestock, et cetera, et cetera. Well, there was a big program sponsored by Sears nationwide where they found young women garden leaders that were working in their 4-H groups to lead people into developing victory gardens and establishing that. And this was an event that happened in 1943 where those young ladies were all pulled together from across the nation and rewarded for their efforts. I really love their little hats and their little 4-H aprons. But anyway, back to Chicago. This was a Boy Scout troop that felt that they liked to march in formation to their garden because it prepared them for when they were going to be drafted. A little creepy. Here's some young ladies ready to garden for victory. They're a little more cheerful than the would-be soldiers in the previous picture. So this is a Chicago Park District photo. This is one of the many successful victory garden projects conducted through Chicago Public Schools. And this one was in charge by a woman named Miss Flersham, principal of the Brennan School. A nearby vacant lot was turned into a very fine vegetable and flower growing plot. A special ceremony and party was held the day the garden was started and plots were assigned. Right through the summer, including the hot vacation period, these youngsters continued their cultivation and insect control. Because of Miss Flersham's excellent leadership, fine crops of vegetables resulted. So this was the photo that showed in the newspaper. Here's the other photo that didn't show, and I like think this really illustrates, you know, what people working with children go through. This guy in the front, I know he got busted for something. I like to joke that maybe he had a sugar high, but since sugar was rationed, maybe it was a molasses high. I'm not so sure. But if you just sort of look at that pandemonium of what those teachers had to put up with to make something like this happen, I really like that photo. So, of course, they all had to report up to the OCD. These were their report cards. It would show their plot number, their row number, the gardener's name and address, have the weeds been removed, have the insects or disease been taken care of, et cetera, et cetera. And then all this information was collected and tallied on up through the ranks. The kids were not immune to the OCD of the OCD.
You are listening to Lamanda Joy of the Peterson Garden Project. Her talk is Chicago Victory Gardens, Yesterday and Tomorrow. But trust me, she's talking about your city and town and your future. This is Radio EcoShock.
So the harvest. We were leading the nation in 1942. We had 12,000 family gardens on 509 community plots, 290 acres. And in 1943, 53,000 family gardens on 1,500 community plots, 14,000 children's gardens, and all of this on 908 acres. Now, this is just community gardens. This doesn't include people that have home gardens or people that weren't joiners that didn't want to fill out the form to get the sticker. This is just the information that we have. And a lot happened in the suburbs, but we're not talking about that right now. So how did Chicago do it? Let's go to the next slide. Let's just reiterate this. We had government support. There were overarching organizational structures. There was a donation of space and equipment. There was mass education, promotion, corporate and individual commitment, and recognition. So let's go on now to today. We talked about 1942, 1943. People often ask, well, did the Victory Gardens just end at this end of the war? I'm like, well, technically they did end. They stopped being called Victory Gardens, but people continued to garden. Immediately after the war ended, they became freedom gardens because the Cold War was starting to percolate. And so you'd see information like food fights the Red Menace. You know, it was still a disaster over in Europe. So people had to get food. And whoever was giving them food probably was the side they were swinging toward. You know, if it was Soviet Union or Russia, it could potentially become part of the Cold War Soviet Union. If it was America, so food was a real tug of war in Europe. After that, around the late 40s, early 50s, after the GI started coming back, inflation started happening. So the gardens were called thrift gardens. People continued gardening to save money. After that, around the mid-50s, people were real, real tired of gardening. You know, the world was changing. We were becoming the American dream. People were moving to the suburbs, getting big cars, and they wanted to keep up with the Joneses in different ways. So that was sort of the end, you know, of the names to the Victory Garden movement. Of course, people continued gardening through that, but from a movement perspective, really sort of moved on to landscape gardening and my house being better looking than my neighbor's house. You know, my roses are better, my clematis is better, whatever that is. So let's talk about today. We have a new motivation for victory gardening. We don't have a universal effort, you know, toward defeating an enemy, but we all have our own little individual enemies, our own little worries that we're fighting against, and they're all valid. It could be the economy, you need to save money, it could be transportation costs, your carbon footprint, food safety, you know, other environmental concerns, GMOs, GE, loss of seed diversity, self-sufficiency, you know, and if you've grown your own food, you know that homegrown food tastes better and better. You know, it's a little preaching to the choir with this audience, but you know that this, the first administration since World War II, Eleanor Roosevelt, to have a food garden at the White House. It took a long time to get that food garden there. Just a little aside, the USDA did not want Eleanor Roosevelt to have a food garden at the White House. Did not want her to have a victory garden. They were worried that the precious resources, those precious seeds, would be squandered by those city slickers trying to grow their own food and failing because of what happened during World War I. After the first season, in cities like Chicago did such a good job, the USDA was more into it. I have found only one photo of Eleanor Roosevelt's victory garden, and she wasn't even tending it. It was the vice president, like some photo op with him and his little girl. So it was interesting that the USDA wasn't interested, which leads me to my next point. You can all collectively boo Tom Vilsack if you want. But one thing that he has done that's interesting, Tom Vilsack is the USDA Secretary of Agriculture. One of his first mandates when he got his position was to start the People's Garden Program. So the USDA is considered the People's Department. It was started by Abraham Lincoln on the anniversary of his birth. He put out this, Vilsack put out this memorandum to all the USDA facilities across the world, there's 30,000 of them, that they should start a garden or they should participate in a garden. So now every state, you know, every state, every province has a people's garden. There's all over Europe, and they've given almost 1 million pounds of produce to local food banks. So kind of interesting. I point this out because I feel like it's the first time we've had the political environment to make a movement like this, a victory garden, a concerted effort in cities to have these huge food gardens happen. Let's also talk a little bit about communities today. You know, people lament that nobody goes to church anymore or there aren't social organizations. People are more, you know, they don't go outside because they have air conditioning. You know, whatever those things that we don't have now that we think people had back then, you know, like we're missing something. But I like to point out that people are forming communities in new ways today. And they want to be together, but they're also using social media in a lot of ways. If you study the statistics about how people learn how to garden, the number one statistic forever and all time is from a neighbor or a friend. It's the best way. The number two statistic has, until 2009, been books. In 2009, it became the internet. So your friends are your first option, or your neighbors, and your second option is the web. So I show you this because it kind of combines the best of both worlds. This book was written using social media. The authors reached out to people that had never gardened before, asked them how they'd like to learn, what they'd like to learn, wrote this book using different private groups on Facebook and Ning and different social networks, wrote the book in 90 days and published it. It's a very good gardening book, very basic gardening book, good stuff. But the difference is, if you have a question on page 72 about the asparagus pea, you can send them a tweet, you can send them an email, you can go to their Facebook page. So you still are able to have that community relationship with people, despite the fact that you're reading a book.
What's the name of the book and the author?
It's called Grocery Gardening. It's by Jean Ann Van Crevelen. This is a garden at 77th and the Lake. This is Rainbow Beach. It's a community garden that was an original World War II victory garden. It's the one existing community garden in Chicago that has lived its whole life from World War II till today. I heard when I was speaking a couple weeks ago that there are three gardens in Evanston that have continued to be gardens since World War II, which is fascinating. A little funny story about this garden. It's on the bus line. You know, the park district doesn't like fencing gardens because they want their property to be available to everybody, right? That's what the park district is all about. Well, this garden was on the bus line, and the bus driver would stop in front of the garden and let people go to the garden and pick food that weren't gardeners and then get back on the bus and drive off. So the park district agreed that maybe in these circumstances it would be okay to have a fence and the lock on the gate so the gardeners didn't grow all their food for the people on the bus. So I'd been doing all this research and, you know, kind of got excited about the idea of Victory Gardens and what sort of impact it could have today. And they seemed to do a really good job during World War II. They had this nice plan. So I thought, what would it be like if we just followed those steps and just recreated Victory Garden? The photo on the far side, circled in my neighborhood, that was an empty lot. Everything else had been built up, but that one piece was an empty lot. So I was driving down, and it actually isn't today because this was 3 years ago. I was driving down Peterson with my husband. I've been studying all this. I've been talking to my parents about it. You know, we had just bought our house a few years earlier. And I'm like, that's the lot from the picture. He's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, the lot from the picture, the lot from the picture. He said, you're going to kill us, right? We were driving. You know, I just had my epiphany, like, that's a lot from the picture. Well, you know, maybe we should try and put in another Victory Garden. So I went to my alderman and I said, hey, did you know that this was a Victory Garden? I'm a master gardener. Why don't we, you know, I've been studying World War II. Why don't we try and put a Victory Garden in? And he said, go for it. So we got a lot of support. So here was my game plan, right? Government support, donations of space and equipment, overarching organizational structure, mass education, corporate and individual commitment, and recognition. Not reinventing the wheel, just doing exactly what they did during World War II. So what happened is we were trying to repeat history. History repeating itself, or as I like to say, history re-eating itself. So we started the Peterson Garden Project. This was our plan. You know, as I mentioned, I'm a master gardener. I've been a food gardener all my life. And so I tried to think through, okay, we want to invite people that had never gardened before. We want to keep it as simple as possible. We want to remove as much complexity as possible so people can go in here and really succeed. So that's how we designed the garden. And I'll get to that a little bit more in a few minutes. You know, so then I was the block captain. I'm going to go to the next slide. You know, one of the block captain's duties is morale boosting. So this was us at the groundbreaking. I'm making everybody do a sing-along. I'm not going to make you do a sing-along today, so don't worry. That's me doing the sing-along. That's our alderman laughing at me. So we used social media to launch this garden. We launched it in April 27th of 2010. And within 5 days, we had 50 people in the community that were meeting at a restaurant to talk about this garden. I thought, you know, if 20 people wanted to do it, it would be fun. And it ended up between those people and the people that joined after that becoming the largest edible garden in the city at that time. Anyway, we used Twitter. These were some of the people that started with us at that first spot. And we had to educate people, right? 90% of the Victory Gardeners in World War II didn't know how to grow their food, so we invited people that had never grown their food before. We did it very simply. You know, all of our beds are raised beds. Now, I'm not advocating one way or another. There's a million ways to garden, and if your food's growing, you're doing it right. But we did it specifically using square foot gardening techniques. And there's a tool on Gardener Supply called the Kitchen Garden Planner. So we had homework for people. What do you want to eat? Here's the size of the beds. Go to this website. Pick what you want to eat. It's a drag and drop tool where you can, you know, grab peppers, and it'll show you how many per square. And then people would bring their homework, and we would teach them from there. This is actually a little video, and I will talk through. Someone always asks, what kind of soil did you use? Where'd you get the water? So I'll answer some of those questions during this video. Now, this is a time lapse of when we put the garden in 2010. I also would like to point out, like 1943, it was an incredibly wet, rainy spring. So every time I planned a volunteer activity, we got rained out. This was the beds. We put in 157 raised beds. It had been a foundation. You know, so there was a building, but it was gone. So there was no topsoil. I personally like raised bed gardening for many reasons. And if you want to know what those are, we can talk afterwards. But we put down 250 cubic yards of mulch, which is a lot. We built the beds. You can see how they're lining them all out now. We put weed barrier in the bottom. And then we got 110 cubic yards of a mushroom compost organic garden mix. We do all organic gardening. We teach everybody organic gardening. And so then people became members of the Peterson Garden Project. They paid a small fee, and then they got assigned their bed. So then here you see the individuals starting to put in the soil. So everybody had to shovel their own soil. And then if you look, you'll start to notice how some of the square foot markings start to develop. So you can see that those are some of the new gardeners. And this was a space of about 5 days. We condensed it down into this little three-minute thing. We had some rain in there, but once we got the, so there you can see the square foot gardening. Once we got the beds put in, it went pretty fast. It was a little bit of a hair-pulling exercise, you know, getting things delivered. Our gate never seemed to be enough for the dump trucks coming in, so we'd have to take the fence down, put the fence up, and if the guy didn't show up what he said, then, you know, like, it was a lot of drama at first. Sure learned a lot, though, that first year. So, you know, sometimes you stumble into really wonderful things unsuspecting. You know, I never really thought anything more than to satisfy my own curiosity. What if we did this? But we learned, you know, there's a famous permaculturalist that said all the problems in the world can be solved in a garden. We learned that very quickly in this garden. People were there for a lot of reasons, and mostly it was for the community. So the food growing was a good thing, but the community that formed out of it was a big deal. So we thought, this worked pretty good. We've done it before. What could we do to do more of this, you know, share this model and make this happen? So we decided that we needed to be a not-for-profit, and we decided that we had a motto, and that was to recruit, educate, and inspire a new generation dedicated to making urban food production the norm, not the exception. And so the next phase, that was the 2011, we started getting very serious about doing this in a bigger scale. So we spent a lot of time in 2011. We had a lot of interest from the press. We had a lot of visits. A lot of people really liked how the model worked, how the allotment-style garden worked. People had it. A sense of community, but they're still responsible for their individual piece. It wasn't, here's a huge space, let's all agree on what we're doing, which is a good thing, it's a good model, but we wanted to have a big garden, we wanted to have a lot of people learning, and so that model seemed to work. This year was the 70th anniversary of the first Victory Garden season of World War II. So before the Occupy Wall Street movement happened, we had a program we were calling 1% for Victory. Couldn't call it that after Occupy Wall Street, but we essentially wanted to do 1% of what they'd done in 1942. So our goal was to put in 5 community gardens, teach 7,500 people how to garden, and have 5% of the produce donated to food agencies. So we were starting, of course, up in our Division 6. That's where I live, and it's very close to our original garden. And so these were the gardens that we worked on this year. Land on Lincoln is, we didn't get our lease in time, but we're building that one right now. Vegwaters and Edgewater, we like to have a sense of humor. Montrose Green is right by the CTA Brown Line stop, so if you're on that platform, you can look down on that garden. Global Garden is at Lawrence in Sacramento. It's a 1.5-acre property that we share with an urban refugee training farm. And Stars Garden is at the property of an old no-till motel across from the drive-thru Starbucks on Lincoln and Jersey. So it's very interesting because it has the star sign up there. So, and we were also very fortunate, we put in a community garden at the Field Museum. This is Diane Wheely. I don't know if anybody here is familiar with Seed Savers Exchange. I'm a big Seed Savers Exchange junkie. They've really influenced a lot of my personal choices about food and gardening, and so it was a great pleasure to get to work with Diane. She's a very funny lady. She said, you know, I always like it when people have a little bit of sculpture in their garden. So that's the Brachiosaurus in the back. That's what she was referring to. We ended up calling it the Broccoliosaurus. So we were able to put in 4 of those gardens. We were able to put the Field Museum garden in this year, and who knows for next year. We ended up having about 2,600 people gardening with us. We had 690 plots. We gave 5% of the food from each of those gardens to local food pantries around the gardens. And, you know, those are the stats of the stuff. But really, the stuff that you don't see is the community. You don't see how taking these spaces and giving people a skill that they can share that applies to everybody. Everybody eats, right? That's the part you don't really see. So, you know, I get to talk about this stuff a lot, but, you know, we have a community of people that stepped up from the very beginning. You know, when I'm out standing in the middle of that big empty lot thinking, am I insane? What was I thinking? You know, how can I possibly do this? And people started coming, like, I can do this, I can do this. I'm in marketing, I'm in fundraising. And this amazing community formed to make this project happen. So, as I said, I stumbled on this idea. You know, I had these stories from my parents. I love gardening, and I was curious. And I'd like to show this next photo. These are my parents today. You know, this is a quote from JFK that I think is really important. One person can make a difference and everyone should try. You know, during World War II, everybody had to try. You know, everybody had to do it. And today we live in a nicer, you know, nicer world in a way. You know, we're not in conflicts like that. We are in conflict, don't get me wrong. But, you know, our world, we're living in the world that World War II created. But I still feel that it's really important that we try. You know, it's good to not try for the perfect. Don't let the perfect get in the way of the good. You know, it's just get out there. You know, if I would have thought about, you know, maybe thought more about that project, I might not have embarked on it. I was traveling 80% of the time for work. You know, I just felt like this is really compelling to me. Surely it's compelling to other people. And it certainly worked out. I also like to point out sometimes with certain audiences, this is one lifetime. You know, this is one lifetime. And my mother says that when she was little, everybody had chickens. You knew how to cut the head off a chicken. You got your eggs. You had a neighbor that had milk. Even in the urban areas, you had access to that stuff. And the food system has changed so dramatically in one lifetime. And I sometimes feel, I sometimes visualize it, you know, like I have my mother who taught me to can and cook and bake, and my dad who taught me gardening and many other really useful skills. And they're old. They're 85, you know. And I sometimes feel like, you know, that stuff is slipping away. Right, those skills, and it's very important not to let that happen. So I feel very committed to the fact that we need to take care of ourselves a little bit more. So that I do in honor of my mom, my Rosie the Riveter mom, but that's what I have to say today about Victory Gardens.
Take a few tips like these from the old gardeners, and you'll soon be growing your own tomatoes, peas that melt in the mouth, carrots that will be a revelation, potatoes at your service whenever you want them, and cabbages fit for a king. There's a bit of ground waiting for you somewhere. And surely, isn't an hour in the garden better than an hour in the queue?
Wasn't that a great speech? So much to learn about how it was and how it could be now. LaManda Joy is the founder of the Peterson Garden Project in Chicago, USA. Find out more at petersongarden.org. The high-quality recording from the Great Lakes Bioneers Conference, November 4, 2012, was made for Radio EcoShock by Kelly Pierce of the Chicago Independent Media Center. Thank you, Kelly. You've set an example for how we can all share important audio. I'm Alex Smith. I'll be back next week with more food for action. Dig in at our website, ecoshock.org, and find links to this week's program in the Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you for growing your brain this week.